right, ladies and gentlemen, welcome back. Thank you so much for tuning in today. Henrik here with Red Ice TV. And today for our featured interview, we are speaking with Tom Rausel, who's back on the show. Of course, he's from Survive the Jive. You might have caught some of the previous interviews that we've done with Tom. He's joined us for many live streams as well. And it's always a pleasure having Tom on the show. So thank you for coming on again, Tom. Hope you're doing well.
Thanks for having me back, Henrik. It's always a pleasure to be on.
You bet. Lots to talk about today. I do want to, a little bit later, go into some updates, some new things in your work, some new, I guess, not new theories, but new science in relation to older theories, which previously have been debunked. There's a lot of interesting things. But why don't we take it from the top, and let's assume that no one actually knows your work. We have a lot of newcomers to the show. There's new people all the time, new subscribers to our YouTube channel and new members and so forth. So why don't you just introduce yourself a little bit, tell us about the kind of areas you've been studying and what your interests are in regards to Survive the Jive, the YouTube channel, and the work you've been doing.
Well, sure. Well, I started off, I graduated with a degree in, a master's in medieval history, and I studied like Old Norse sagas, the Viking mythology, Anglo-Saxon stuff, a lot about the Anglo-Saxons because I'm English and I was very interested in my own history. And I wanted to know a lot more about English paganism. And then after that, I went to make a film, about this called From Runes to Ruins. And I came on Red Ice in 2015 to talk about that. But I already had a channel from long before then called Survive the Jive. I've been doing that since even before I got that master's degree. It started talking about paganism on it around 2009. So it's been about 10 years I've started talking about European identity in history and paganism, like European religion, that kind of thing. And it's grown very, very slowly. Like some channels blow up, but I mean, now I've just this week reached 50,000 subscribers on YouTube.
Congrats. And that's,
it took a long time to get there, but it's still growing. But I'm always, so after I finished a degree in learning about Germanic paganism, I'm still learning more all the time. And I've branched out to learn, to try and learn more about other kinds of European religions, Indo-European religion, and also to understand Indo-Europeans. I've started to read and understand a lot more about genetics and, or specifically population genetics, because that's a really fast developing science at the moment. And it's really useful for historians to help us understand European people and where we come from and the history of like everything that Europeans have done.
And I mean, it has to be a more treacherous field today, if I could put it that way, than ever before, considering the fact that we're dealing on top of things, Tom, with a lot of just propaganda and just untruths, a lot of lies when it comes to genetics and differences and populations and even movements and things like this. How do you wade through all that and get to the core of what really is going on and just try to kind of exclude what has become, I just for simplicity's sake, let's just call it propaganda, but there's a lot of other layers kind of to unpack within that.
Yeah, well, that's exactly what I'm trying to do with Survive the Jive. So I know that a lot of the media misrepresent findings. You have like the Cheddar Man fiasco and everything where they try to make a Western European hunter-gatherer, they try to portray him as though he were the same as a sub-Saharan African, which isn't true. But actually the science that's happening now is really vindicating a lot of things that right-wing people have always believed. And the way the media try and spin the science is to try and reinforce left-wing narratives of history and of trying to justify modern political actions. But actually, the more we look at the science, the more that's revealed from this science is the more that they have to admit that human biodiversity is real, and that the different types of people, what have historically been called races, the social constructs called races, actually correspond with biological realities, and that, you know, many of the historical events that historians have been denying and trying to claim there's not enough evidence for, such as the Aryan migration into India or the Anglo-Saxon invasion of England, these things really happened, and now we have genetic proof. So it's just a case of going back to the actual original science, and then I just lay it out in clear terms for as much as I can on my channel so people can understand what the truth behind this stuff is, instead of getting the filtered version through the media.
Yeah, and that's a tall order to do, right? Especially in these times. But it feels still, though, to be honest. I mean, we'll get into Cheddar Man later. I think it's hilarious, to be honest. the way they try to pitch this and sell this. And oh, I got to put up later too. There was one new show coming out in Sweden. I don't know if you, I'm sure you saw it on Twitter. The it was basically the same thing. They're picking up all the first Swedes were dark skinned and stuff, and like there's no way for them to actually know that.
Well, it's really interesting. I mean, I talked about the Cheddar Man video in a couple of I talked about it a few times. I actually did a video before the Cheddar Man, before the Swedish thing, back in 2015, I think it was, where I called the first Europeans, where I talk about Western hunter gatherers among other ancient European groups. But then more recently, I did a video responding to Philosophy Tube, where I talk about this recent Swedish depiction of a Western hunter-gatherer played by an actor of sub-Saharan African origin. But, you know, the original, even before Cheddar Man, we knew from all the Western hunter-gatherer skeletons, and these Western hunter-gatherers are basically, that's the term geneticists use to describe all the people that lived in Western and Central Europe in the Mesolithic. And all of them that we found so far, when they look at the genes, they all have blue eyes. Not like modern Europeans where we have different colored eyes. They all have blue eyes. And another thing they notice is that they don't have the genes associated with light skin that are present in Europeans. So that led some scientists to say perhaps they were dark skinned, but the problem is, and some geneticists have said that, there are many genes that can affect complexion. And these individuals may have had genes affecting their complexion that aren't present in modern human beings. So we can't tell for exactly what complexion he had.
Right.
But we might infer it's possible he had a dark complexion. But what we cannot say is that he was African, because the closest living relatives to the hunter-gatherers who lived all across Europe, from Spain to Sweden, are modern Northern Europeans. So actually, the more pale you are, the more genetically similar you are to these people.
Yeah.
So, I mean, the idea that then they could say Africans were close to them, they're not related to Africans at all. And in fact, their blue eyes are, of course, a very European phenotype. And we know that this phenotype of blue eyes evolved here in Europe among the hunter-gatherers in Europe and is an indigenous phenotype. So wherever you find it outside Europe, you know, it's from Europeans spreading out.
Yeah, exactly. And so what we might be looking at, and, you know, again, it's kind of difficult to piece together, of course, this whole thing. And there has been tremendous movements. There's been climactic changes. There's been, you know, things that happened at different times, including, you know, cold snaps and even some areas that go through desertification and stuff like that, which have caused people to move in different directions. But there is that overarching kind of idea that you had a hunter-gatherer first in the northern climates, and then at some point you had a warrior-like culture that did come in. And originally that was known as like the Aryan invasion theory or the Kurgans, right? I forget who, Maria something, the first popularized that one? Yeah, exactly.
She's Lithuanian.
That's right. But then this wave come trying to put that down, right, and say, no, that's actually not what happened, right?
Right. Well, I mean, there were two competing theories at the time, back in the post-war era, for like the origin of Indo-European languages. And for those who don't know, Indo-European languages, it's just a linguistic term for a type of language family, which encompasses most of the languages spoken by most human beings on the planet now. And that means everything from Spanish to English to Hindi, Urdu, basically. Most of the languages in India, which is why they have the Indo bit at the beginning, and then most of the European languages, with the exception only of Basque, Hungarian, and Finnish, all the other European languages, and all the ancient European languages like Latin and ancient Greek, those are all relate. They all come from one language, and if they all come from one language, then that means there must have been one person who spoke them. But there was because of the political correctness after the Second World War, people didn't want to accept that there was a race that, you know, spread these languages. Instead, they wanted to just say that, you know, and including one respectable historian, Colin Renfrew, Sir Colin Renfrew, who was opposing Gimbutas, he's saying, no, this stuff spread from just like interactions he thought that it came maybe from the Near East, and that it spread with farming. But Colin Renfrew, being a humble and decent academic, has recently said, I got it wrong. I spent my whole life arguing this, and I know now that I'm wrong. And all the scientists have realized the truth now is that there is Maria Gimbutas. She got it right.
She did,
got it right.
Yeah.
There The farming from that came from Anatolia is not related to the spread of the Indo-European languages. Rather, it came from a very warlike group of people from the north, from the north of the Caucasus Mountains, from Ukraine and Russia, and they came and completely changed Europe and parts of Asia, and they're the source of all the Indo-European languages, and they were a race of kinds because we can see their genetic signal. So as an Englishman, I can expect to have like more than 40%, 45% of my DNA, if you're British, will be from them. And if you're a Swede, then even more, you're probably like somewhere near 60%. I can't remember the exact figures, but people in Northern Europe have a lot of their DNA come from these horse riding warlords who just took over Europe, basically.
Yeah.
And they were a people, and now genetics is showing that all kinds of things about them. And it's very interesting because we can see also how linguists and scholars of religious studies are showing that these people also influenced all the pagan religions that we know about from Europe, whether that's Celtic or Nordic or the Roman religion. All of them come from this one ancient religion from like 8,000 years ago. And yeah, that's a Kurgan on screen now. And one massive part of their religion was burial mounds.
That's right. That's now, where do we see them? Right.
Yeah, all over Sweden, right? Yep. They're all over Sweden. They're all over England.
Yep.
They're all over much of Northern Europe. And they start off with around Russia and spread with these pretty fierce dudes. And I find it really fascinating. So I tried to go into that so that Europeans can be aware now of this part of our history, which is being unraveled before our eyes, to show us like all these things that actually a lot of academics believed this anyway in the 19th century. But then in the 20th century, this whole process of like questioning whether this was real and saying that this was just like problematic or whatever. Now we're going back and actually showing that all these, you know, 19th century Victorian historians were pretty clever because they got it all right in the first place.
That's just it. I found that too, you know, which is very interesting. Like, the, you know, there was a 19th century, a lot of interesting signs were being done. And then, of course, that, as you said, that just totally was put on its head after the Second World War, because it was a lot of things that kind of was weaved into, I think, just overall the interests that the National Socialist had. It didn't matter if it actually was correct or not. It was just by the fact that it was tainted by that. So they were almost forced to throw that out this will lead to that. And obviously we know that that's not necessarily true. It's always better to follow the academic truth no matter where it leads, right? They had some things which were off, you know, obviously, but some things where they were right on. But this goes back way, way back into the record. And I pulled up one article here too, which I think is interesting. Let's pull this one up here. It's talking about the Scandinavians are the earliest Europeans. I'm sure you are aware of that one too. Svante Paabo, a couple of other ones, were doing some research on this too. Now, I don't know if this is before or after the Kurgan invasion. This article is talking about three different groups in particular, right? We have the Denisovo, we do have the prior hunter-gatherer, whatever we want to term that, and then I think it's Neanderthal kind of involved, weaved into that as well. I don't know if you're aware of this article here.
Yeah. Svante Paabo is a Swedish scientist with a Finnish name who, he was big on the whole Neanderthal thing. He's the one who's revealed to the world, like, you know, Neanderthals weren't just some other primitive species. They're part of us. Like, all European people have Neanderthal DNA. In fact, all non-black people have have Neanderthal DNA. But we have different Neanderthal DNA in Europe from the Neanderthal DNA that Asians have. And the DNA we have from Neanderthals affects us in different ways, even today. Like, some of the way we look and behave in modern times is actually thought to relate to this little bit of Neanderthal DNA that we still have. And it's not just Neanderthals. Svante Paabo and other people, scientists today, are finding out that other species of hominids interbred with other Homo sapiens to create hybrids, and that's what's contributed to the biodiversity of the human race today. For example, Denisovans, which all Asians have, and, you know, Australasians especially, like, have quite a lot of DNA, a significant amount of DNA from Denisovans. But there's also other stuff which we call ghost populations at the moment. Because when you've got a Neanderthal skeleton and you've got the DNA out, then we can say, oh, look, that's the same DNA that Henrik has, so he's got Neanderthal DNA. And the same with Denisovan DNA, because they have Denisovan skeleton. But there's lots of kind of species that we don't have any of their DNA, but we can see DNA in modern humans, and we don't know where it comes from. And especially, like, there's a ghost population in Asia that is not Denisovans or Neanderthals that contributed to the Asian DNA. And there's another one, I think Australians, native Australians have yet another species. Besides, they have Neanderthal and Denisovan. And Africans who didn't leave the African continent in the migration out of Africa. So therefore, Africans don't have Denisovan or Neanderthal DNA. But they do have DNA from other species that we don't know about that remained in Africa. And therefore, there are no pure human beings. Rather, all the different races of man that exist today are hybrids of entirely different species.
Right. And so that's where we get this idea of like some kind of melting pot, or that those interpretations have been made so that kind of in a way to make an excuse like, well, there isn't a pure, group or whatever. Therefore, it doesn't matter for the preservation. But the obvious thing is, no matter if that was true, no matter if that's the case early in the human record, separation through time and in different climates and stuff has created very distinct differences. And obviously these are most easily provable by seeing the visual expression of them. We can see visual differences. You can point out different people in a crowd, right? And say, this person belongs to this subgroup that, and this to that, et cetera, which means that there is different genetic components of us, right?
Exactly. So like there's two ways that human beings can start to differ from each other. One is because of hybridization with an entirely different species, which we know has happened and contributed to the diversity between different races. The other is, as you say, just from separating. We can take the example of the Tibetans. The Tibetans have only been separated from like the normal Han Chinese ethnicity for about 5,000 years. They became a breakaway population up in the mountains, and they have already evolved in that small amount of time a special evolution in their blood that allows them to, process oxygen at that high altitude, which is essential for survival in this environment. So the idea that, we have to be going back, hundreds of thousands of years in order to be differentiated from each other is not true. In a very relatively short amount of time, humans start to evolve for their environment. And we are, all of us, all different humans, are specifically evolved for specific parts of the world.
Yeah, it's fascinating, isn't it? And, I remember that when the Scandinavians are the earliest Europeans article came out, I remember in the wake of that, let's see, that's the one again, there was a couple of interpretations that came out, right, that talked about this, and they were trying to kind of construct around a kind of a melting pot propaganda piece around this whole thing. And there were a couple of good articles that was released about this. That kind of clarified why they went in this direction and stuff like that. But again, what's interesting to me is that regardless of how we would interpret that and whether that is the ultimate truth or not, it's clear that these distinctions and differences do exist now, and different traits and things have come from that, and different cultures have come from that, different languages have come from that. So the importance, of course, to preserve that and look after that and also kind of associate whatever group you belong to to get you to realize that, we can just talk about Europeans, first of all, and say this proves also that Europeans are native, right? Because that's one of those big things we hear all the time, that that we're not ethnic, which is just a misapplication of the word itself. Everyone belongs to an ethnicity. Everyone has come from somewhere. Everyone has those native traits. But they're almost trying to seem that Europeans is the only one that don't have any of these things, right?
Right. And it's actually unusual because if you look at, the criteria for terms like native and indigenous are actually constantly shifting and being negotiated to fit whatever, in specific scenario that the person using them wants them to mean. But it's very difficult for them to use this kind of terminology for certain peoples around the world and then exclude Europeans, because Europeans are, so much we have, like most of our, like, although we're a mixture of different peoples, every single race on the planet is a mixture of different peoples, but we have been unique in and as a phenotypical group and as a genetic group for, the Caucasoid or like European style skull and, you know, shape of the kind of human is prehistoric, going right back into the Ice Age. But the specific, like even like the modern style European, even like how we are now in this specific genetic identity that we have, which is modern, that's still like 4 or 5,000 years old and completely homogeneous within that time, heterogeneous, like it's not been like interfered with.
That's right.
Like Northwest Europe for 4,500 years.
Yeah.
I mean, and that, if that's not long enough to be classed as a native, then most of the native, so-called native populations in the world can't be classed as native.
That's right.
So obviously they change these definitions when it suits them.
That's right. And you can see, of course, the stoneworks, the record of these people as well. All over France, England, Scandinavia, Denmark, Germany, even further down, there are different tumuluses, there are stone passage graves, there are all kinds of things which goes back. Some of them even I know an area up in Sweden, it predates the pyramid, you know, some of these stoneworks. I mean, it's incredible stuff. There's like this one street where they're just lined one after the other, which of course goes back to the fact that this was an important area. Many old important families or chieftains was located in this area, and there has been continuous activity on that road even till up till today. And these are the populations which have had probably in Europe the least interference, as you said as well, into them, right? So there's a, right, almost a clear line there.
So the argument that they might use to oppose this is that the Neolithic Europeans were different from us a bit. Like Neolithic Europe was populated by a people, like all of Europe was populated, but was quite less diverse than it is now. Even like there was this homogenous population of farming people when farming was first brought to Europe. And basically Europe was a lot, most Europe, even Sweden, was pretty much genetically a lot like Spain is now. So it was still white. It was still European. And then the injection of the Indo-European DNA at the end of the Neolithic makes the modern European diversity of peoples that we know now, from the Swedish, Lithuanians, the French, the English, this kind of like this genetic profile start to emerge. But that was just from what we now consider to be white and European. It was white and European before, and it was white and European after. And even the Indo-European people coming in were Europeans, people that are European racially, and the people they preceded them were also European. So like the fact that, like, if we went to an island, like find some island tribe, and we hear that, oh, actually a neighboring island once invaded and the people there are a mixture of two islands, we don't then say, like, you know, they don't apply this idea that, oh, therefore they're not native. That wouldn't make sense, because they're still the same people. They're just two different neighboring peoples who have blended with each other.
Yeah, that's right. And what do you think? I mean, I was arguing with some person, I think it was on Twitter, they were denying the reality that different groups exist, that there are subgroups within the human race, right? And they were just trying to say, well, the science had tried to prove that, and there's nothing to it, and kind of thing. And I think I felt that much of this argument, and this is of course kind of the staple in our day and age today. There was one video, actually, there's videos after videos after videos trying to debunk and put this down. And I just feel that there's a lot of political agendas kind of behind that, because I've heard someone point out in the past that even if a doctor didn't take race into consideration, he could do incredible malpractice issues, because right, there are differences. There's even this issue of the fact that organ donation is difficult between certain groups and things like that. There is like clear genetic differences, you know.
Even a pharmacist has to be aware of race, because obviously, I mean, basically, there are certain drugs that won't work properly with certain ethnicities.
Yeah.
And pharmacists are, like, there's a new form of pharmacology emerging called pharmacogenomics, where they're specifically looking at making, you know, drugs that work for you based on your DNA. And of course, each individual has different DNA, so that can be at an individual level to some extent. But some negative reactions from drugs we know specifically occur in certain populations. And these groups, populations, happen to correspond almost exactly, or very often exactly, to what we now identify as racial groups. So if someone identifies with a racial group, that racial group that they self-identify with also corresponds to a biological reality which is useful and relevant for scientists and pharmacists to know about. And of course, this isn't just something that to do with medicine and pharmacy. I mean, the Harvard University's leading guy for like population genetics, who's basically the leading guy for population genetics in the world, and leading authority on it, is a guy called Professor David Reich. Now, he's not like us. He's a left-wing liberal Jewish guy, but he has come out and said in the New York Times, in an article for the New York Times, that we have to like admit now that race is real. I got some quotes from him here. He said, it's simply no longer possible to ignore average genetic differences between races. Differences in genetic ancestry that happen to correlate with many of today's racial constructs are real. Genetic variations are likely to affect behavior and cognition just as they affect other traits. Pretending that scientific research has shown there can be no meaningful average genetic difference among human populations is contradicted by scientific facts. So,
what was his name again, you said?
David Reich.
David Reich. Okay, I'll pull that up here.
Svante Paabo before that. It's part of the same crowd, like in population genetics.
I see.
He's well known and well respected in the field. And you know, he got a lot of flack for that article, but from like mostly from people who aren't scientists, but also from a few scientists because they're getting nervous. But like, this is changing. Like the narratives. Like the left have had to completely reassess their narratives because they've always gone with that, you know, mantra, race is a social contract, race is a social contract. But it isn't just a social contract. It's a social construct based on a biological reality. So it has to be recognized, and it's actually dangerous medically and obstructive historically not to acknowledge the biological realities of the social constructs called races.
Yeah, exactly. And the sad kind of flip side to that, or one of the side effects of not recognizing those kinds of things, is like what I saw in one video. I think it was about the signs of racism, and they were talking about this issue of the different medications that you brought up, and they said this, that they won't prescribe certain medication to, I think it was black people in this case, right? And like, well, that was done for a reason. You know, they try to argue, well, it didn't work as well or whatever. And I can probably imagine that it was because the original studies that had been done had been because they were developed for or by Europeans or something like that, or maybe Asians or something, right?
Right.
And then that had to be like, you know, adjusted to fit and work better for them. So there was a delay in the application of the medicine for Africans, basically, right? So so it's nothing to do with like intentional racism. Anyway, go on.
They called it racism because a lot of these medical studies are done on the sample groups were not representative of global diversity.
That's right.
So they're often young white men who just want some extra cash, so they'll let you test drugs on them. But that, of course, the assumption that all human beings are genetically the same when they're not.
No.
So make a drug really safe. It needs to be tested on entirely different races. And they need to record like the different types of reactions that different populations have to that drug. And that's, you know, that doesn't fit into the narrative that's been banging on them about for so long. So there was only a matter of time before this house of cards fell down, and it's starting to fall.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. And it has to fall. I think a lot of disservice to the kind of works like, Stephen Jay Gould, right, the Measure of Man and things like that, which was completely politically motivated, right? He wanted to try to change what he saw was a fallacy under, again, I think it was primarily under National Socialism. They tried to say, well, that's wrong, that's bad, so let's go in the opposite direction. And he has even been forced to retract a lot of things, and he was heavily even, reprimanded in different ways because of this work. But it stood for a long time, and it feels like, as you say, the academic world has kind of begun to update itself to be in the right position again, but culturally, the cultural narrative has not yet done that, and we're kind of right at the cusp, maybe, of getting on the right track again.
Yeah, I mean, I can't remember off the top of my head, but I believe after the Second World War, it was written somewhere in the UN, like based on some science they had at the time, and like, you know, primitive science of the 1940s, 50s. That there was no, you know, meaningful genetic difference between races, and therefore this kind of stuff, they needed to, it was an object of mankind to come overcome these kind of, sort of regarded as kind of superstitions. Now there's, scientists don't think that like that anymore, but like the overarching, like political structures that have, that as the, you know, the new pieces of, of power fell into place after the Second World War, they're still based on these false assumptions. So what needs to happen is a change, to shift ideology and politics to accept the reality of science. And of course, the media is in Britain and in many other places is controlled by people who still really find this stuff objectionable. So whenever something happens, you know, some new thing happens in, like, we find out about European history or something, it has to be spun into a thing that, you know, that's more palatable to the globalist tastes.
That's right, exactly. So a lot of hurdles to kind of jump over and get to the real story. Now, let's expand that and say, okay, so we're looking at the different, the differences, biologically speaking, genetics, and kind of the early story, the early saga of not only mankind, but just the specific, the European people as well. Now, what are some of the, I guess, traditions, and we can call them religious, religion for the sake of simplicity, that you've been looking at and how that kind of have spread? There seems to be, if we start at the beginning, there seems to be at least originally kind of a very much of a shared, common, mythology, I guess, within the European branch. Would you agree with that?
Yes. I mean, one thing that we can easily see and measure with to its origin is the Indo-European aspects of shared religion, the religious themes in European paganism. But there was, of course, religion practiced in Europe before the Indo-European religions were brought in. And it's very hard for us to say much about that. Obviously, we can look at the megalithic structures like Stonehenge, and we know that these people were agricultural. So whatever their religion was, it was definitely based to some extent on the seasons, the solar alignment. And of course, we know that they were farmers, so they're going to be very conscious of the seasons. But really, it's anything beyond that becomes somewhat speculative because we don't have any written texts. We don't have statues of their gods. If we find any statues from that prehistoric times, we don't really know what they are. But when we come to look at Roman religion, when we come to look at the Greek religion, we got texts. When we're looking at the Viking religion, we've got texts. We've got archaeological sources. When we look at folklore from the Celtic people, from Baltic people, from Slavic people, we can look at these and we can see big similarities, really noticeable, not coincidental. And that's because they definitely have come from this common source of the Indo-Europeans that we mentioned earlier. And as you can see on screen now, that there was these solar symbols that were common in them. It seemed that they brought chariots into Europe, these guys, and horses, and they were warlike. So they were some of the early metal users in Europe. They were bringing bronze weapons. I think the Indo-European invasion hastened the Bronze Age, basically, in Europe. And their religion, to some extent, incorporated war into it. Their gods used the new technologies that these men themselves used, that's horse-drawn chariots. And they had solar imagery associated with their art. We can see that in like this Trondheim chariot from Denmark, which is from the Nordic Bronze Age. It's a horse drawing a solar disc made of gold. And gold was not as big a thing in Europe among the Neolithic people as it was once these people come in. Gold is suddenly a part of religious iconography and remains so right through all pagan religions. And I mean, it's quite obvious, it's shiny, it's beautiful, it's valuable, it pertains to the sun. And these people had some kind of important solar principle that influenced their religion. And we can see elements of that in later manifestations. But another thing that we're familiar with when we talk about paganism, we always think of like gods, right? The gods in the sky. And most of what we think about when we're thinking about this, whether we're talking about Odin and Thor, or whether we're thinking about Zeus and Hera and the gods in Olympus, well, we're thinking about Indo-European notions of deities, because this idea of like a race of gods living in the heavens, ruled over by a god king, like a sky father who has, you know, the highest power of all. This is something the Indo-Europeans believed in and brought into Europe and into India.
Yeah, the sense of hierarchy a little bit as well, right? The king was a new thing. I mean, I think they probably had chieftains, but it was more divided. There's a new rulership and organizational capability that came in with this change as well, with this new people. And as you said, they were, it was so successful that they just steamrolled over, you know, anything that came in their way. And in many cases, I think the prior group that occupied those territories in Europe were probably much more peaceful. They were just hunter-gatherers. They didn't have the organization capacity to do those kinds of things, but doesn't mean that they were all, I guess, softies, right? But they were, but they, there was no match towards the new guys coming in.
Well, basically, at that, at the time when the Indo-Europeans came, South Europe was all, was more densely populated with people farming. And Northern Europe, like Scandinavia, the people there practiced farming a bit, but they were still more reliant on hunter-gathering. And Scandinavia and Northern Europe in general was far less densely populated. So that's why the Indo-Europeans had a much bigger genetic effect on Northern Europe than the South, because the South absorbed them. But the Southern Europeans still adopted their language and religion, but they didn't change the genetics as much. Whereas the Northern Europeans, they definitely did change their genetics a lot. But as you're saying, like, they're more peaceful and stuff, it's been inferred by people like Maria Gimbutas that because we know for a fact that the Indo-European people coming in were patriarchal, warlike, and, you know, violent, that perhaps the Neolithics were the opposite. They were more egalitarian, more peaceful. Well, the problem with that is we don't actually know that that's true. We know that the Indo-Europeans were warlike, and we know that they were they believed in patriarchy, and we know that they were, you know, that they won overall, and that they were had a more strict version of hierarchy. That's evident from their burial customs, and more focused on individualism, whereas Neolithic burial chambers are kind of communal. Like when the Indo-Europeans have a big burial mound, it's for a great man, and then other people come to worship at this place. So, but we can't tell for sure that much about what the Neolithic Europeans were really like. I mean, they could have been all matriarchal, they could have been egalitarian, and some people like to, you know, they really want to believe that. And maybe it's true, but it's kind of, you know, I don't want to speculate because I don't, we can't say. But whatever we, what we can say is that they got BTFO'd by the Indo-Europeans.
Yeah, that's right. It's a fascinating story. And of course, even in some of the sagas, you kind of have this with the Asir on one side and the Vanir from a, which seems to be from a prior age. Now, these two sets of people and gods obviously kind of merge, but there's great battles between them before that occurs, and before you kind of get a single culture out of that. And there's still some differences between them. In many cases, the Vanir is a little bit more, how can we put it, nature-oriented, maybe? Some of the, you know, there is some farming element, agricultural too, I guess, to a certain extent. Yeah.
They teach the Asir magic in the Asir magic. Yeah. So, yeah, like, and that's not just in Nordic religion. There's often other religions where there's this conflict between two Indo-European religions, where there's these two sets of gods, or if not gods, then like opposing forces. Where, and you see it with the Devas and the Asuras, for example, in the East. And this could be a memory of this, an ancient conflict or merging of peoples that happens, and that it's been transferred into a religious form, that it's sacralized, that these events were sacralized and made part of their divine view of the world. But
what would you say about that? Because obviously there's clear, I almost see a division too between a land-based culture and then a sea-based culture as well. And I don't know what the merging there is, but if we look at the Nordic rock carvings, for example, I do believe there are some chariots on some of them, but most of it is boats. It's still the solar motif, interesting enough. There's solar boats, but you can see things in Scandinavia that you can see in northern Italy, that you can see even to a certain extent Egyptian style rock carvings as well that have similar boat shapes. The boat people, where do they fit in all this?
Well, I have a theory about this that I developed actually because before I even started getting really into the Indo-Europeans and around 2015 and really digging deep into it, I already developed theory because it was based on, I tried to do a PhD proposal about why boat burials and boats in general were such a big part of Germanic pagan religion. So we all know about like Vikings and how they loved their boats and that they had boat burials. But actually, boat burials go back way before the Vikings into the migration era and the Vendel era, which are the eras immediately before the Viking era in Scandinavia. And even before that and throughout like you know, from the Bronze Age and into the Iron Age, you've got in Sweden these boat-shaped stone circles. And in the Nordic Bronze Age, you have hundreds and hundreds of these little golden boats they were making. And as you said, they had lots and lots and lots of carvings of boat pictures in some kind of ritual context from the Nordic Bronze Age in Scandinavia. Now, boats were a really big thing, and it's a massive cult thing going on for like well over 1,000 years, or a couple of 1,000 years or something like that. Well, more than 1,000 years anyway. But the point is, why is that? There is only one other Indo-European religion in Europe where I thought the boats had a kind of comparably important role, and I thought that was in Greece. And then I think my theory was this. Like, in Greece, they had the islands. Even before Indo-Europeans arrived in Scandinavia or Greece, people there were using boats, and boats were important because of the geography of those two places. Greece, because it's like, you know, all these archipelagos of islands and stuff, and Scandinavia, because the inner land of Scandinavia was very thick, dense forest, no decent roads, no easy way to get across the country. So people used to get around, you know, through the river systems and fjords and lakes. And
there's a lot of rivers just crisscrossing the whole landscape there, by the way. So that would be easy, including people can't go to those locations a day and say, well, this is too little. It was higher water table, right? Or what do you call it? Higher water at that point. And
Lake Mälaren. Lake Mälaren was part of the sea back then.
Exactly. But, that's right. Yep. And even the, you know, Göta Canal and some of these areas, they were huge. And they still are in some areas, huge, huge rivers, you know, but even more, way back then. And you have small little canals crisscrossing. And so that was the highways at that time. That was the way to right. get from point A to point B.
Exactly. So my theory was that the Indo-Europeans who had developed a cult of the chariot and the horses, where horses like so important in Indo-European religion, all the gods had horse-drawn chariots, all the horse sacrifice. Not only do we see that it remains like a really important part of Viking religion right up until the end of conversion, but you can see in ancient Hinduism before they became all the vegetarians and stuff, the horse sacrifice was a major part of it. And horse sacrifice everywhere, like, you know, on the steps, the steps of the Pontycastian step, you can see it was big. And they brought this chariot horse-based religion, like the chariot being like conveying the sun, conveying the gods into Scandinavia. And where Scandinavia was different from other places is where, like, when the Indo-Europeans went other places, it was more like an elite imposing themselves on the populace. And then the general populace didn't change as much. But in Scandinavia, we see from haplogroups that actually Sweden has a lot of I1 haplogroup, which is the haplogroup of the hunter-gatherers used to have before Indo-Europeans. But they still have that Indo-European blood, which shows that there was an interbreeding between the Indo-Europeans and the Scandinavian people that was different from elsewhere in Europe. That meant even the men could take Indo-European women. So there wasn't this like an Indo-European elite. There was more of a kind of understanding of some kind. There was more equity between the hunter-gatherer, like, or whatever, that like farmer hunter-gatherers in Scandinavia, the Neolithic Scandinavians, and the Indo-Europeans. Now, the pre-existing cult that was, or culture was all about boats. It makes sense then that the Indo-European cult of the wagon and the chariot and the horse was supplanted by a new one focused on the boat, where the boat takes the role of the purveyor of the sun. And this is what we can even see in some of these rock carvings you see now, where there's it appears to be carrying the sun. So,
And these go back, I mean, this is the Nordic Bronze Age. Yeah, exactly. It's way, way, way back. Yeah.
Yeah, it's old. And now modern evidence is showing that there was interactions between the Baltic, Scandinavian, the Nordic Bronze Age and ancient Egypt. So like that amber was a really important part of religion in the Baltic, whether Baltic people or Nordic people. Because it was looking like the sun. It's like a drop of the sun. Even the ancient Greeks used to love it. They used to say it was the tears of Apollo. Egyptians did too, but all the amber in Egypt was coming from the Baltic. And then we can see in Bronze Age burials in Scandinavia now that they got little beads that were made in Egypt by King Tut's own bead maker. So there was this interaction between these two cultures. And obviously that was going to require boats as well. So
yeah, that's interesting, isn't it? Yeah, I remember that too. The amber trade routes is very, very important. And you can see clear traces even down to northern Italy as well between the rock carvings is one area. I think it's Salamonica or something like that. I forget the exact name. Rock carvings are like pretty much identical. But even as you said, some of the earliest art found on the planet is in Egypt. And those rock carvings look like they could have been in Tanum in Bohuslän in Sweden or something like that, you know. I should clarify, partly in like in France too, the Lascaux caves.
Those are much older, yeah.
You know, that's way back there. But so some of those, like the way they depict like the animals and the bison and, you know, certain animals like that, it's like a copy right over. But that what I was thinking about was that region in northern Italy and Sweden. That's very similar, you know.
Yeah, definitely. And those are both from much more recent. They're from the Bronze Age, whereas these cave paintings you see in central France were from the Aurignacian period or the Gravettian period. And that's a time when the entire population of Europe was less than 3,000 people. So it was just a few people. And probably a lot of them were living around those caves in France. Yeah. That was probably one of the center of activity. So, and like, they're not as close to us as these guys who did these carvings in the Bronze Age, who were really just the same as us.
Yeah. Yeah. Fascinating. I mean, it's an amazing story, and there's so much there that we don't get to that we don't get to enjoy, I guess, to a certain extent, right? Because, you know, there's a lot of baggage involved in or has been, and we shouldn't assume that. We shouldn't talk about it in that way, of course. It's our traditions. It's our heritage. We're part of the story, obviously. But, you know, again, every time you have something where Europeans feel like they belong or they have something which is important for them, which justifies a preservation of those cultures, the language, the heritage, and even the biology to a certain extent. That feels like that has been under attack the last 7 decades or so, Tom.
Right. And it's important because it's been shown that children who are of any race, who are taught to be proud about their history, who are taught about their history, who are taught about positive role models and great achievements of their people in history, benefit from that psychologically, because they're able to go forth in life holding their head up high, knowing where they come from, who they are, and that, you know, they have a place in this world. They have a right to their place in this world. And left-wing people know that because they're often talking about, you know, we need positive role models for Black kids, we need positive role models for Middle Eastern kids, whatever. We need to, you know, celebrate their history and culture. So they know that it's important for a human being, the development of children. But they don't want it for when they don't like it when Europeans say, oh, we're proud of this, we're proud of that. So this is the big problem. We need to have that. And that's what I'm trying to create, like some material for adults, maybe mainly most of my stuff is for adults to understand, you know, but we have so much to be proud of so that they can tell their children about it. But I'm also making cartoons with other people, like I'm collaborating with a cartoonist to make stuff that's also kid friendly too. So we have these materials that can, you know, you can give to kids and get them like to be interested in and proud of who they really are.
Now we should show some of that too while we talk about that, by the way. Now we talked when you were on the live stream, we talked about the Yule story that you had, and that was obviously that was primarily a book, right? But you guys made a video out of that too. But it's the same artist, and you're going to expand some of the work together with him.
Yeah, that's right. So I made 2 Christmases ago, I made a cartoon with this guy, a cartoonist and an illustrator who's a great illustrator called Christopher Steininger. His name is Smile Titans on YouTube, and you can see some of his work on screen now. And he and I worked on this like Christmas horror story, which actually tells you all about what pagan Christmas was like before Christianity and how like the Anglo-Saxons and Vikings used to celebrate Yule and celebrate with Odin instead of with Jesus. But then the following Christmas, this Christmas just gone by, we made a book version of it, which we thought that would work very well for kids because they like to have something tangible and you can get that for them as a Christmas present. And then they get to experience all that, you know, opening it up and learning about their history in a fun way with cartoons. But then now I'm going to work with him again. Coming up, my next project is a cartoon which is explaining an Indo-European myth of the golden apples. And it looks at Greek, Celtic, Nordic, all these different myths with these apples as a motif. And then shows how they connect to one Indo-European origin. And he'll use his skills. Christopher is a great illustrator. I love his drawings. You can see to bring this story to life in the form of a comic book style animation. That, I mean, and I love comic book style animation. It's the modern storytelling format. And so we're updating the myths in a way to make them more palatable to modern tastes.
Yeah, and that's really important, obviously, by the way. If something for the kids, I got to get a copy of the book. Yeah, let me know how to purchase a copy of that because I want to show. Is it in English primarily?
It's only in English. We didn't do a translation, but I'll send you a copy. No problem, yeah.
Oh, thank you. I'd love one. Yeah, it's great. I have a couple, of course, for Rorik already, and he loved the Viking stuff. He's even learned how to do we have a fabric axe kind of thing. You know, he picks it up and he just goes like that and stuff. So he's into it already. He loves seeing the images and stuff, you know. And that is really important. And, you know, when I grew up, I didn't really... That took like my own digging to really get to that. And I remember when I started to kind of getting into the political topics that concerned Sweden and what direction it was developed politically, I would say that was primarily because I got interested in the history in the area where I had grew up. And I headed out into the field myself. I looked at these, you know, the huge, you know, rock formations and passage graves and tumuluses or burial mounds and stuff like that, and started like reading up about each site. How they related etymologically, how it's related to the mythology, and coming across alternative information and mainstream information as well, which really just opened up a different window, if you will, altogether into a sense of belonging, a sense of like, hey, we have something here which is special. I mean, I spent my 20s. Looking at all kinds of other things, like the Mayan calendar and Hindu things and Buddhism, you know, all over the place, right? And then you realize you have something right at home, right in your own backyard, which is like our own mythology. It's tied even to the people which preceded me. It's a beautiful thing when you discover that, you know.
Yeah, I mean, I think a similar process happened for me. It's so important because it brings the landscape around you to life. It's no longer just a place. It's, you have a connection with it and your ancestors. And even if you live in America, so you're not, you know, you don't have your ancestors going back so far, you should still be like knowing about, you should still be knowledgeable about your recent ancestors in this area and how they came to the United States. But just as we in England have to be knowledgeable about our Anglo-Saxon ancestors and such, because I've traveled a lot in the world. I'm fortunate to have done that and met all kinds of wonderful people in different cultures, which I appreciate. But when I see other white people doing that, I often think that their way of doing it is such as like they want a surrogate. They try to live vicariously, experience the cultures of other people in due to the absence of a feeling of a culture of their own.
Yeah.
So culture becomes something that they travel to experience, whereas the culture is what you inherit from your ancestors. That's yours. So if you can't, and when I appreciate other people's culture, it's with the same knowledge of how I appreciate my own culture, because I, you know, the experience you were talking about when you know that this land, this burial mound was built on this date, and that the man who was in it was called this, or that the name comes from this word that your ancestors used, and that this man in this mound may very well be your own ancestor, and that the people who practiced the religion in this area were all related to you, and that this, you know, you have, the landscape becomes alive with the meaning of history and the meaning of the spirituality of the people who used to live there, instead of just, you know, an area where a shopping mall hasn't yet been built.
Exactly. Yeah, and that's kind of how I remember that, you know, the teenage years and stuff, and it was so, everything was so boring, right? This, and even the names, it was like you just dread, it was like always, it's a rainy Wednesday associated with, you know what I mean? It's like, no, there's nothing there. It's just gray and boring. And of course, Sweden has long, dark winters and stuff, right? So the summers are magnificent, though. Lovely. I miss him greatly. But anyway, but when you discovered that it was like things of historical importance there, there even have been things dug up from the ground, which has, you know, religious significance. And, you know, it becomes really exciting. And it becomes alive too. It becomes like something that you're part of, and that that story continues. It's not something which is just dead and gone. You know what I mean? That the story of both the people, but the tribe and the nation in the extension it's still going. It's still there. You know what I mean? And it links you right back to that past, and you realize that it's just a long chain of individuals that's come before you, and that you're the ultimate expression of that. What do you call it? The preserver. You're the guardian of that to a certain extent.
Exactly. Like, history lives in us. Our ancestors live in us. They existed for us to live now. And we're the next link in the chain, and we've got to carry that on, and we've got to honor those who came before, and we've got to, show those who come next how to do the same.
Yeah.
And that's really important, because when people get broken away from these essential aspects of being, like understanding your ancestors, understanding your landscape, understanding history, understanding the gods or spiritual perspective on being, not just pure materialism. That's what life really is about. That's what makes life worth living. That's what all human beings and all races in all of history have always centered their lives around. The anomaly, the strange and freakish, weird form of existence is this new one, where everything is about the prices of things, the values of stuff, the material worth, and who has what and how much, and whether that's fair or not fair, etc. This and the idea that, races don't exist, or if they do exist, they ought not to, because they only divide us, and we ought to all be united under one banner of grayness, and everyone can be a consumer and buy this products, that they want to define themselves. The idea that you define yourself in your purchases, that you are an individual, that your life is a blank sheet, that you get to write, and you will write it according to where you work and where you spend the money that you earn from your work. This is a falsehood. You are the authentic form of existence for you is to acknowledge who you really are. Where do you come from? Who are your ancestors? What is the culture that you were raised in? That's who you are. And that's how to, and when you engage in that in an honest way and try to honor those truths and your ancestors from before you, then you live authentically.
Yeah, I think it's a fallacy to associate it with, there are divisions already, obviously. And the fact is that every other group, they do have the roots that they cling on to in their heritage, and no one is denying them that, obviously. And it's a great thing that they do. It roots a lot of different, individuals. I think it, as you said, add on to this, we have to take this issue of the emergence of a global culture for control purposes, but there is an efficient way which both market interests and then political, usually left-leaning interests, have kind of aligned in a sinister agenda, a coalition, if you will, to try to uproot us, to try to make us into these malleable individuals that don't have these links to the past. And let's face that, that would mean that it's simpler for them to shape and mold us in a way that is separate from any past. It also makes sure that we don't end up in the situation where we feel that we need to preserve something or preserve who we are. If there's no link there, if you're not aware of any link to the past, then what is it to protect, right? That's usually what I realize, that if you don't understand what it is that you have in your own backyard, why would you be interested in protecting that? You don't even know what it is.
If you're not capable of feeling a collective identity, then why are you going to feel any despair or dismay when that collective group is attacked? You're not capable of you're being robbed of your natural faculties of perception, and the most important ones that, like, I mean, when they chop down parts of the Amazon rainforest where tribes live, they, you know, that it's not just like for those people, those trees aren't just like the place where they hunt animals. They're like, this is their whole world. It's not just, it's their food, it's their life, it's their ancestry, it's their mythology. It's like everything. It's like the whole, everything they know is being destroyed. Like, I remember there's a story of an Aboriginal Australian tribe who had this pole that was to them the link for them between the earthly domain and the heavens. that linked them to the gods. And one day it was broken. And they were so, the despair was so great that they just decided collectively that they would all lie down on the ground and die, just wait for death to come. And that's something that should speak to us about how human beings really, what they really are important to them. And when people are scratching their heads over, why are people in the West so depressed? Why is suicide rate so high among white males? What is it about white males that's now different from other people in history? What's been taken away from them? Well, it's this natural feeling of connection to their traditions and to their life and to divinity and everything, that we've already spoken about. Obviously, whatever the motivations of the organizations that are trying to take these things away, it can't be denied that they are, the results are awful. They're terrible.
Yeah, definitely. It's a crime. It's a crime. And as you said, drug use, endless other activities and entertainment and escape to try to fill that void, you know, that people lack after true identity and roots and stuff like that. So it's very, very important to become whole and complete. And again, it's like, to a certain extent, it doesn't matter what time or epoch or era you kind of you find most interesting or you latch onto, if you will, there, just that directly speaks to you. Begin there and read more about that, study that, learn that, because there is something to it. And, you know, it's the same way that I remember we can round off the first segment on this here, but, and we'll talk more about, your YouTube channel, how people can subscribe and all that stuff in a moment here. But I remember the story about someone describing, an ant. They were learning about an ant, right? And all the different components and the parts of it and the head and the, you know, the antennae and the different parts of the body and everything had a name and how it functioned and worked and stuff. And where initially you just thought, well, it's just an ant, right, kind of thing. But when this person broke every component down and how they worked and that they had different names and stuff, you realize that it was like a universe within just this little one ant, you know, and all the different little components and stuff. And when he knew the words of them even, it opened up. When the vocabulary opened up, his ability to think about the different parts that makes up the ant gave him a completely different appreciation for it, right? That's why it's important to know, and that's also why it's important, I think, for those who we've been talking about, they're involved in the sabotage of us reaching our heritage and connecting with that, to limit our language and limit our ability to look at this thing. And what is more beneficial, at least in this day and age, to associate them with bad things or something like that, right? It's an easy shot to take that route to try to disconnect us from our roots, Tom.
Right. I think it's exactly right. Because if we haven't got... I mean, some people have a question early on in the channel, like they didn't understand what are you doing talking about, you know, stuff that happened so long ago. We've got problems now we've got to address. Like, why are you talking about this stuff? But I'm trying to explain that what are you fighting for? Like, what shop is it? Shopping malls? Is it, you know, is it television, soap operas or whatever? It's not like we've got such a great history to be proud of, and it's really old. And whether you're talking about things that happened in the 19th century or in the 19th century BC, there's so much to talk about. There's so much to be proud of. And just learning about it is not just accumulating useless information or like tidbits, you know, for like dinner time conversations. This is stuff that enriches your life and enriches your worldview. It helps you to see everything in your life in a proper and real context. You know, because the time should be viewed in this way, like is the huge expanse, the cycle of time and which we're a part of and that we're continuing for the benefit of our ancestors and descendants.
Indeed. Now, I want to continue this conversation in part two, much more to get into here. Maybe we can get into the nitty gritty of a couple of examples. And, you know, there's much more to just kind of break down here. This is just kind of a very, very basic, like, overview, both of your work, but also the kind of the general picture of diagnosing the issues that we have and kind of try to put our finger to both why this work is important, what we can gain from understanding it and how we should relate to it. But there's just so much more within that. But before we take a break, Tom, let's just kind of plug your stuff here a little bit. You're, of course, on all the social media as usual, YouTube, Facebook, Twitter, where people can follow. I think you have like an Instagram too, but, yep. You just broke, as you said, 50,000 on the channel. So congratulations on that. Great work. A lot of good material on the YouTube channel. Tell us a bit more about it.
Thank you very much. Yeah. So the YouTube channel is gone over 10 years now. And, you can subscribe to it. Please do subscribe to it and add to my 50,000. I want to keep going as much as I can. I on Facebook, the Survive the Jive, it's the same name everywhere. If you Google Survive the Jive, then you'll find all these different things, all the different social channels. Facebook and YouTube are my main ones because I put more effort posting on Facebook. I have a Twitter where I occasionally tweet, you know, frivolous things, but a bit of good stuff too. And Instagram is just photos of me out hiking and looking at ancient stuff and whatnot. But YouTube is the main thing. And you'll see, I've started doing live streams now every week or two, where I just talk about all kinds of different stuff. But my main, the content that people know me for is historical videos where I go and visit specific locations. Like I went to Stonehenge recently, or I go to, I went to India and made a long film there about my ancestors in India, because although I mainly talk about ancient Germanic paganism, the Iron Age, or in the Bronze Age, I also talk about sometimes some other recent things or just folk customs. Like I look at, you can see on screen this flaming tar barrels in Devon, or like the worship of apple trees that they do in parts of Devon for a January celebration, which goes back to pagan times. And the one in India I did was just looking not only just at ancient Hindu customs and their relationship to the Indo-European paganism, but also just at like Victorian British history in India, because my family used to live in India in the 19th century. So you see, it's quite a diverse channel covering DNA, religion, and nature. But people who subscribe get what that is all coherent. It's all about one worldview, which is with one function, which is to inspire joy and pride in European people about who we are and where we come from.
Now, do you still have From Runes to Ruins? It's available, right?
Yeah, From Runes to Ruins was I've made three feature-length documentaries. From Runes to Ruins was the first one, and that's the only one that's not on YouTube. It's a pay-per-view on VHX. You can, if you Google From Runes to Ruins, it'll come up. And that documentary is about Anglo-Saxon paganism specifically. It was made in 2013, finished in 2014. And then the other two films, if you want to see something for free, the one's called British History of Ceylon, which is about Sri Lanka and my family in Sri Lanka. And then the other one is the India, passage through India from Aryans to Empire. So those two I put on for free because not everyone wants to hear about Victorian stuff. I understand Victorian British Empire, but From Ruins to Ruins, yeah, if you want to see that, it's only $4 to rent it, and you get to see it as many times as you want over 3 days. But actually I also can send, if you're a patron, if you become a patron on Patreon, I can also send you a free link to that anyway. So, you'll still get access to see From Ruins to Ruins if you're a patron.
Right, yeah, exactly, because it's important to continue to support people like Tom so he can continue doing this full-time and getting the important information out and continuing to kind of explore a lot of the things that is in our record, because it just never ends. What are some of the areas, quickly here towards the end, that you'd like to look into, or maybe even areas you'd like to visit that you haven't already done, or certain favorites that still are unexplored?
Well, I mean, in terms of things I want to look at in future, I'm going to be going to Cornwall and to Poland in May, both times to film rituals. In Cornwall, I'll be filming a May ritual, which goes back to pagan times. And in Poland, I'll be filming modern Slavic pagans and showing how they do their pagan rituals today. And I haven't done enough on Slavic culture so far. I did one in Lithuania, where Lithuania's happy paganism.
That's right. I remember that one. That was good.
But yeah, so I'll do that. I also think I should do a video where I just explain once and for all, because not everyone's understood how the Aryan migration into India happened, mm-hmm. and why the evidence shows that it did happen, and that the people who migrated into India were essentially European people at the time of that migration, and that they brought in all the Vedic culture and stuff. So I don't need to go to India to do that. I went to India last year for that other film, but I don't need to go back to do that, because it's just a discussion of genetics. But I may also go to look at some of the other Indo-European cultures at the fringe of Indo-European world, like Lycia, which in Turkey, I might go back there and look at some of the old ruins that they left there. The Lycians they were like ancient Greeks, but they spoke a different language, which was not related to Greek, but very closely, but it was an Indo-European language. So it's quite interesting to know about it.
I'd like to travel down like the Volga or something, or the Tray routes, or the where the Varangians went or something. That would be really interesting. Or even like the where the no one has found, right, the Jumsvikingar, where that ever was. There's an island, mythical, that was maybe it was in the Baltic, I think, towards either Poland or Lithuania or something.
I thought it was near northern Germany or northern Poland, the Jumsviking. Yeah. But yeah, I would love to go to the actual steppes. I should do that one day and just go and like go to Ukraine and from Ukraine to Kazakhstan, like over from Ukraine, Russia, and just look at all these old burial mounds of the Yamna culture. One day I'll do that, I think, if I can get the money for it. But
endless areas to explore, for sure. You know, it's fascinating story. All right, guys, make sure you subscribe, of course, to the YouTube channel, and then also Patreon, or get a copy of the film from Runes to Runes that we talked about. That helps, of course, as well. And of course, check out Facebook and Twitter. But Tom, great first part here. We're going to take just a short break, and then we're going to be back with the second part and dive deeper into some of the areas we haven't covered yet. So stay with us, everyone. Stay with us, Tom. We'll be right back. Wonderful. Hope you guys enjoyed that. We're going to continue with Tom Ravzel in part two at redicemembers.com. Head on over there. Subscribe if you haven't already. Try it out for a 3-month subscription. See if you like it. We have a lot of exclusive material available for you there. Not only the second part of most of the interview shows that we do. Also, of course, Weekend Warrior, a dedicated news show that we do exclusively for members. And we have other exclusive videos there available for you as well. Archives go back to 2006. So we have thousands of hours of material. So definitely make sure you check it out. It helps us as well, of course. But yeah, we'll continue with Tom, talk more about the political situation, but about a couple of examples of things that have happened recently, these controversies where the fake stream Quackademics are trying to manipulate information and data that's coming out in order to skew us away from focusing on our own heritage and what we have in our backyard, and skewing that and saying that it's been more multicultural than it actually has been. So we'll break some of those things down, talk about a couple of specific historical / mythological characters as well that kind of is interesting, that Tom enjoys reading about and kind of looking up to at the same time. So a lot of good stuff coming up in part two, so tag along at redicemembers.com for much more of Survive the Jive. We'll be right back. Thank you for watching or for listening.